Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 344 of the podcast. It's Friday, 20th of October, 2017, as I record this from San Francisco, very early in the morning, as I still have jet lag. I've been here, since Monday. So yeah, I've been up between 2 and 4 a.m. every morning, but at least I'm getting lots of work done before the sun comes up. So today I have an interview with Ryan Holiday about his book, Perennial Seller, The Art of Making and Marketing Work That Lasts. We talk about positioning, changes in marketing and the book industry, how to make your body of work last, as well as balancing ego with serving the reader. So look forward to that coming up. Right, so I'm really enjoying San Francisco. Everyone said that it was a lovely city, and indeed it is. And I've had some mostly lovely sunny weather and wonderful walks around the Bayside because I've been up so early. I've sort of been out before a lot of people, and I've walked down by the water in the early mornings, and it's just been lovely. The pelicans flying overhead, which are very cool. I've done lots of walking around the parks, sort of big walks from the Ferry Building all the way to the Long Now Foundation, if you know about that, at Fort Mason. They actually have years in with five digits. So right now is 02017. And because they have this sort of 10,000 year clock, and I find that very cool, long-term thinking. So that's, they have a cafe and a place at Fort Mason. And I've walked at Land's End. And I also went to Alcatraz on the Early Birds ferry and found the medical wing, which was a bit of a highlight, the operating room and the hydrotherapy area, which is basically waterboarding. And I found out about that when I wrote Delirium, which was about the sort of early days of psychiatry when it was essentially torture. Also visited the De Young and Legion of Honor museums, which are really great. Found lots of interesting stuff there, including some William Blake and just really interesting things. I also really like the Mission District and visited the Mission Dolores, which is the oldest building in San Francisco, I think, certainly the oldest church, one of the early missions when the Spanish came. And also yesterday visited the surprisingly awesome Grace Cathedral, which doesn't get much of a look in the tourist notes or what people recommended to me, really brilliant. It has a labyrinth and a rose window based on Chartres in France, which is probably the most famous labyrinth in the world. Has a 13th century Spanish crucifix, which I think will be appearing in a book. A triptych by Keith Haring, which is really amazing. The Doors of Paradise by Ghiberti. It's a replica, obviously, but the originals are in Florence on the Duomo. And it was so cool to see them there. I was like, what the hell? This is so weird. So it's, and also they have some quilts commemorating those who died in the AIDS epidemic. So it's one of these really interesting places that has all kinds of interesting bits and bobs from Europe. And for me, that is pretty awesome because the ties to Europe are what I'm going to be putting into my next Arcane book, which will somehow link New Orleans, I always say it wrong, and San Francisco. So I'm very excited about that. I also went to the Columbarium, which is pretty cool as well. Found some interesting story ideas there. You can find my pictures on Instagram, JF Penn Author, and also my JF Penn Author Facebook page and on Flickr, and I'll link them in the show notes. Okay, so I've got one more day here and then heading off to Oregon for the business workshop with Dean and Chris, which I'll be talking about next week. Also, if you would like some scary books for Halloween, I'm in a bundle of 10 awesome stories featuring demons, vampires, magic, and serial killers,
although not in the same book, although that could be interesting. My own Gates of Hell is in there, along with the Feel the Fear anthology, which contains my short story, The Dark Queen, which I wrote about the Sunken Cities exhibition at the British Museum last year. Super creepy underwater city with lost gods. Also, Mark from Kobo, well known in the industry as being just a lovely man, and he really is. But Mark Leslie is Mark's other darker side, and Mark Leslie has Eye Death in the bundle. And so if you think that Mark is just a super nice guy with no dark side, you've got to read some of his horror. So yes, check that out at storybundle.com/fear. And that is a limited time, pay what you like promotion, storybundle.com/fear. Right, also super useful for everyone who struggles with collating book sales data from multiple sources and who doesn't want to give away passwords, which a lot of those sites do. Book Report does an awesome job of Amazon KDP only, but many people use spreadsheets for collating sales data from Kobo, iBooks, Drafts of Digital and other stores into usable data. I only do this once a year now because at the end of the day, I count money, not book sales, but I would love to count book sales again. And I like TrackerBox, which has only been for PC for ages, but currently TrackerBox has a Kickstarter for a Mac version. And I pledged within the first 10 minutes of it opening because I am so desperate for this. So if you would like data collation on the Mac for your book sales, check it out. Go to Kickstarter and just search TrackerBox Mac, or I've put a link in the show notes, and that is very, very cool. I really, really want this, so please pledge. That's TrackerBox for the Mac on Kickstarter. Okay, so thanks for all your emails and tweets and comments this week. And remember, you can always let me know what you're doing while you're listening to the show. At The Creative Pen on Twitter is the best place, and you can send me a picture. So Rachel Amphlett, listening to the show while finding creative focus between Campbell River and Tofino, Vancouver Island, with a lovely ocean picture. Hi, Rachel. Marina B, listening while preparing lasagna. The result was yummy. Certainly looked yummy from the picture. Food for the thought and the mind. Robin Lyons, listening to how to find creative focus while preparing the last of the Roma tomatoes for freezing. It's so interesting how many people cook while listening to podcasts. I definitely do. Jonathan and I pretty much always, which whoever is cooking is always listening to a podcast, which is cool. Dr. Joanna said, you asked for pictures. This was along my commute, maybe too cheeky, and was a picture of a pumpkin van with a pumpkin man in it. Kitchen counter author, checking out the Ophelia storm damage, listening to the show, sent a picture of the broken tree, and I actually flew out of London as the skies were red from Ophelia, so that was quite interesting. L.E. Thomas Jr., listening while walking the neighbourhood in the wee hours of the morning and it's raining. Christine Headley, marathon catch-up on holiday in Cluny in France. So lovely to have people all over the world. Just a couple more. Anya B, walking in the First World War Memorial Graveyard in Duisburg, Germany. And also Holger Nils Pohl, listening in Hamburg, Germany, while out running, and sent a picture of windy water. Okay, so lots more from people this week. Thank you so much. I love to hear from you. Really awesome to look at all these pictures from around the world. Shows that we have a global audience out there, which I get very excited about, as you know. Right, so today's show is sponsored by Draft Digital, new sponsor for the show, and I have a super author tip coming from Kevin Tomlinson with some funky music, bringing a bit of, sounds a bit like a late night show host to the Creative Pen podcast today. So I use Draft Digital to distribute to Nook and other retailers. I go direct to Amazon, Kobo and iBooks, and I use Draft Digital for other stores. You can also get a free author marketing guide at draft2digital.com/pen, P-E-N-N. And Draft2Digital is draft2digital.com. /pen. So this corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. Thanks to new patrons this week, Alyssa Lawless and Catherine Barbie. I really do appreciate the Patreon support, like your tweets and emails. It demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And of course, if you support the show on Patreon, you get the extra Q&A audio, more of me every month. A whole 30 to 40 minutes of me answering questions from Patreon supporters, and you can get that for just a couple of dollars a month, less than a coffee a month, especially because certainly the price of coffee in San Francisco is pretty expensive. So yes, you can get for the price of a flat white, you could get 2 whole months of Patreon support at the basic level. Okay, so you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, so here's a word from Drafter Digital, and then we'll get on with the interview.
Hi, this is Kevin Tomlinson with Drafted Digital, bringing you the D2D Smart Author Tip number 1. Did you know you can format your ebook for free with Drafted Digital's ebook conversion? You don't even have to distribute your book through D2D to use this free tool. Just create or log into your free Drafted Digital account, upload your manuscript as a Word doc or RTF file, and let D2D do all the work. Conversion takes only a few seconds, and you can download your book to use anywhere and any way you like. You can even choose from a large library of beautiful, professional ebook templates, and that will really make your book stand out. We've been working hard to create an ever-growing selection of very cool, very attractive templates that give your books the professional polish that makes readers take notice. No special operating system or computer required. Log into D2D from any browser on any operating system and get started. And of course, because it's D2D, it's free. And if you'd like to reach the widest possible audience, be sure to use Drafted Digital's free ebook distribution to major online retailers worldwide, including Apple iBooks, Kobo, Tolino, and more. Start reaching a bigger audience now, convert your manuscript, distribute it online, and get the support you need the whole way at drafteddigital.com/pen.
Today, I'm back with Ryan Holiday. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
Oh, it's great to have you on the show. It's actually been May 2014 you came on the show, so over 3 years. I know.
That's crazy.
I know, it's really crazy.
It goes, I mean, look, I think when you have, as you would understand, when you have your head in a book that you're writing, time both goes incredibly slow and incredibly quickly.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So just in case people don't know you, Ryan is a best-selling nonfiction author, media strategist, and book marketing expert who has worked with clients like Tim Ferriss, Tony Robbins, Google, and Penguin. His latest book, which I have here for those on the video, is Perennial Seller, The Art of Making and Marketing Work That Lasts. And fantastic book. So let's get into it. So let's start with definitions. So what do you mean by perennial seller?
Well, so it's an industry term, right? If you pull up the fine print on the New York Times bestseller list, you'll find that perennial sellers are not included in the bestseller list, right? And what they really mean by that are books that are more than a year old and that sell steadily without, let's say, blowing the doors off. So it's in publishing, the other word for it, right, is a backlist title, a title that sells year in and year out, week in and week out. It's not topping, you know, any charts, but it remains perennially relevant and renewable in that way. And so those are the books that I try to write. And I think, you know, ultimately, that's what most of us are trying to do as writers. That's sort of the goal, right? I want to be the book that people are still reading 10 years from now.
So why do you think that the industry doesn't seem to value those books as much as ones that rocket and then disappear?
Well, it's interesting. On the one hand, they value them very dearly in the sense that probably the majority of revenues in the publishing industry come from those titles, right? The reason that a publisher can afford a building in Manhattan is not because its new titles are selling like crazy. It's because books that they acquired 10 years ago or 15 years ago or 50 years ago are still selling. You know, Penguin Classics is the an enormous revenue driver for a publisher like mine, Penguin Random House, because those are books that they don't have to pay a royalty to an author to, because Homer and Seneca and Charles Dickens are all dead. But also because those books continue to be relevant. They get taught in schools, they get, bought in airports, et cetera. So on the one hand, they're very valuable to the industry. And on the other hand, they're very rare. It's very hard to set out to do one of those things. And it's very uncertain whether it will work, right? So, a book like What to Expect When You're Expecting, which has been in print for 30 years, is the definition of a perennial seller. But it doesn't contain anything new in it, right? There's no groundbreaking advice. There's no celebrity on the cover. It's very ordinary in some ways, and the fact that it's lasted is what's extraordinary about it. And so I think if you're a publisher, you're an editor, it's hard to go, hey, this little book is going to be the engine that could for years and years. You want to focus on, what's new and sexy and what's going to get media attention and what's going to sell right out of the gate. And then look, you think about it, the editor who acquired What to Expect When You're Expecting is almost certainly not at that publisher anymore, right? Mm-hmm. So although the publisher as a business makes a lot of money from things that were created many, many years ago, the people who are there often aren't going to be there for many, many years. That makes sense.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because, what you're saying there is, a lot of the things aren't necessarily new but you still need to continue to be relevant. So how can an author evaluate a creative idea in terms of making a perennial seller? Like you said, you want to write books that are perennial sellers. So what are some of the key ingredients, I guess, that make something relevant long term?
Yeah, I think what you're doing is you're looking for the timeliness in a timeless idea, right? So when Jeff Bezos says, we want to focus on the things that don't change, what he means is we want to be a cutting edge company that's driven by technology, that does, great groundbreaking things. But at the same time, humans, who are going to be our customers, they're going to be the same, right? Mm-hmm. So they like things that are cheap. They like things that get delivered quickly. They like having a wide selection. So it's sort of, what are the timeless elements of your work? What are the timeless parts of the audience that you're reaching, right? So if you're writing a novel, that novel has to be really, really touching, or it has to be deeply emotional, or it has to be really entertaining, right? You have to actually think about where the audience is going to be with the book. When I write my books are nonfiction, and I'm thinking, okay, they have to be very practical for the reader. They have to deliver a lot of value, and that value has to be value that's going to continue to be true over time, right? So this book needs to be as true to a 17-year-old as it's going to be to them when they're 40. That's what's going to keep the book being recommended in work. So you have to think about those things in advance. I think far too often authors just make whatever it is that they're trying to make, and then they hope that they magically checked off these boxes.
Yeah, it's a good point. But how do we deal with things like technology? So in, Perennial Seller, you are talking about marketing, and marketing, of course, changes. And then for a novelist, I mean, even I read my books from 2011 and the cell phone technology was different. So how do we deal with that kind of technology? Because you're a tech guy and a lot of your audience are also tech savvy. How do we do that with a perennial seller?
Yeah, I mean, look, when I was writing the book, Snapchat was called Snapchat. And by the end of the book, it was called Snap. And then by the time it went to print, Instagram had rolled out stories and largely replaced Snapchat as like the sort of the main video social network. So you want to make sure, I mean, one of the things I really thought about when I was writing this book, because there's a lot of marketing in it, is how can I write about marketing in such a way that it's not going to feel dated very quickly. I did a book on growth hacking a few years ago, which is a sort of a futuristic style of marketing. But what I would try to do in those books is go to the fundamentals, go to the mindset side of things. If you're writing very, very tactically, you just have to know that you're probably going to have to update this book over time, or it's going to get dated more quickly than a book that's about the sort of more timeless elements.
Yeah. And then another thing that's interesting is, you know, there are a lot of great books that fail to become perennial sellers or even fail to sell. And there are books that will probably stay in the public consciousness, like 50 Shades of Grey, which, you know, may well be, well, probably is a perennial seller more than, say, a Pulitzer Prize winning novel. So how do you sort of make the difference between a perennial seller in a kind of commercial sense and something that people might consider quality literature in time?
Well, that's what's so interesting is that I'm not sure I would define 50 Shades of Grey as a perennial seller. It was unquestionably a bestseller, a runaway bestseller. But there was a story just a year or so ago about thrift stores in London that were like, please don't bring any more copies of 50 Shades of Grey, because all these people had bought it and then they sort of regretted reading it and then they wanted to get rid of it. So I would imagine that its sales, although because it was such a big success, it might be selling more than you know, your average book. Mm-hmm. I would imagine its sales went all the way up and then almost all the way down at this point. It was a phenomenon that had a few years, but there are many, many bestsellers who were even bigger than the 50 Shades of Grey in the early 1900s and the 1950s that are almost completely forgotten today. Meanwhile, you know, a book like Moby Dick comes out. It isn't exactly appreciated when it comes out, but it's now sold steadily for 150 years. So I think what you're looking to do, it's not that writing a bestseller or writing a hit is somehow a bad thing to do and that you shouldn't do it. What I really wanted to do is focus on a specific kind of book that I think too many people are chasing trying to be a hit right now, when in some ways it's actually easier and more attainable to make something that sells steadily over time.
That's interesting. And I was also sort of thinking about your concept of ego. I believe you have the ego as the enemy tattoo on your arm as well.
I do. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I've been thinking about this because partly for me, you know, people say, oh, what do you want your legacy to be? Do you want your books to live on after you die? And I think that's partly actually an ego thing, is to say, I'm important enough that I want my work to live on. So how do you balance that ego with serving the customer, the reader?
Yeah, so it's not about leaving some sort of monument for history, in my opinion, but it is about making something that continues to deliver value for people over time. So what I'm proud of, for instance, on The Obstacle is the Way, Ego is the Enemy, is that if I died tomorrow, those books would continue to sell, not because like I would be in an obituary, like not like Tom Petty, like Tom Petty's, you know, sort of songs you know, spike in popularity because his death is such a publicly mourned event, but because my books are selling for reasons that have nothing to do with me anymore. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? But it's like if you write a book that does a job for people and you get it out to a large enough audience, what then happens is that audience continues to pass that book along, and they really don't even care that you're the one that wrote it. Do you know what I mean? I do continue to market those books, no question. And I would encourage authors not to quit on their books. But my point is, if you do it right, your book is an advertisement for itself. And each person that reads it generates more readers. And so the legacy for me, when I'm thinking about a perennial seller, it's not about, you know, providing a legacy for my children. It's about creating something that that lasts because it does a good job. And hopefully I'll be around for as much of that as possible, right? And I'm also not, you know, if you think about what backlist means in the publishing industry, a title is considered backlist after 1 year. So when we say something is perennial, we really just mean that it's lasted for longer than that, and that if you can just push to be a little bit longer than the average book, you're going to do well.
And it's interesting because I think the indie self-publishing space is a lot more about backlist. Like it's all about, you know, making money off the backlist. But in the book, you talk about persistence, sacrifice, survival, and creative crisis, which are all sort of big topics. So what mindset shifts and work practices are needed for an author to make it long term?
Well, your book is not going to stand the test of time if you don't put time into making it, right? So I think we like this idea of like the author that locks themselves into a hotel room and in 2 weeks they have a finished manuscript. Like, that can work, but I think it's more the exception than the rule. And so, you know, it's really putting in the work, I think, is the first thing. If you're not doing the work, why would the work last? Mm-hmm. And then asking yourself, why are you doing this? Again, if you're doing the book because you think it's going to make you famous, because you think it's going to make you rich, that's going to tend to actually decrease the quality of the work. And it's actually going to make it harder for you to persist through the negative parts. I'm in the, you know, in the deep, unpleasant part of a manuscript right now. And if I was doing this because, you know, I wanted everyone to say that I was awesome, I'm not sure that would get me through this sort of period. But the fact that I think that this is really important, that it really means a lot to me, that I feel like I have something to say here, that's what gets me, you know, to sit in front of the computer for hours on end.
Mm. No, absolutely. So you talk about positioning in the book and genre. So what are some of the things that authors need to do to position their book?
Well, you know, first off, just knowing where your book fits in the market is very important, right? So everyone goes, oh, I want to be like Malcolm Gladwell. And it's like, well, have you worked at the New Yorker for 10 years? You know, do you know everyone in New York media? The answer is, are you published by Little Brown? These are things that matter, right? And so you have to know where your work fits in the market really honestly and objectively. I think that's part of it. Mm-hmm. And also, what genre is it in? Like, I hear people go, oh, it's a little bit of this genre and a little bit of that genre and a little bit of this genre. And actually, that tends to make it very confusing for the reader. You think that by combining genres, you're getting three times the audience, let's say, but actually you're getting one third of the audience, you know? So if it's not, every project has to be clear what it does for the reader, who that reader is, and why they should check it out, right? And these are things that are both creative decisions, but also marketing decisions, right? So when I see a book that's, you know, got a crappy cover, and then the author goes, oh, you shouldn't judge a book by its cover. Well, it's like, well, what's the point of the cover, right? So these decisions, I want the writer to take everything about the book as seriously as they take every word in the book.
But it's interesting because you work with a lot of authors, and so do I, obviously. And yeah. Also, and it's very difficult being self-aware enough, especially when you've just written a book, to understand where it fits. You know, yes. I've got, especially with fiction, like I've gone back and repositioned books because I'm like, okay, maybe they fit there instead. And you kind of, sure. It's very hard to know your own work. Do you see that with authors, and how do you help them through to actually figuring out where they fit?
Well, first off, it's definitely an art, not a science, right? Like it's not so clear as we would like it to be. But mm-hmm. I do tend to find that we're often in love with our own work to mm-hmm. a degree that the audience isn't. And so one of the reasons that editors are so important, or collaborative partners are so important, or even a marketing person is so important, is that they're seeing what you're doing for the first time from a much fresher perspective. And so if you don't, like, Harper Lee turns in To Kill a Mockingbird and her editor says, this is not a fully formed novel. Well, obviously she thought it was, or she wouldn't have turned it in, right? Or when Adele turns in her album 25 at 25 years old, she thinks it's done. And Rick Rubin says, you know, it's not. And they in both cases, they spend almost 2 years reworking those masterpieces to be masterpieces. Mm. And so you need that voice, I think, often to go, it's pretty good, but it needs to be better in the following ways. Or you think that what's really interesting about this work is plot number A, but it's actually plot number B, or this theme that you weren't considering that's really intriguing to the average reader. And then you can use that, you can sort of merge those visions together. I think collaborative partners are essential on any project. If you're going it alone, the margin for error gets much, much higher.
Mm. Well, it's interesting there because you mentioned Harper Lee and Adele there, so spending years on one project. And there's almost these two positions. One, you keep working on the same thing to try and make that sure. the thing. And then, or you go with the sort of Isaac Asimov approach of write 500 books, of which sure. only two will be remembered. Or Dickens, you know, incredibly yeah. prolific. So, and I tend to, you know, I'm like, you know, I'm on the more prolific side than the yeah. masterpiece side. So what do you think about that balance?
Yeah, like I think Woody Allen's a great example of this too, right? Let's do a movie every year and 5 or 10 will be classics and some will be forgotten, but they're all good. You know, he thinks they're all good, right? I'm not a huge Woody Allen fan, but he wouldn't say that some are bad. He just some are better than others. I tend to be on the prolific side too. I tend to work quickly, but that doesn't mean I'm rushing anything, right? So just because you work quickly doesn't, it's just that some authors work more quickly than others, but I don't think any of those authors should be rushed in what they're doing. So if you're proceeding with a book that you don't think is as good as it can be, I think that's a mistake. If you can make great work more quickly than a Harper, like ideally Harper Lee would have been more prolific too. I mean, I think the world is worse off for her only having written one book. Right. So, more is better, in my opinion. I think quantity is a way to get to quality. But if you're not putting in the work, I don't think that work is going to last.
Yeah, I think you're right. Okay, so, you know, when you were last on the show 3 years ago, you had the Growth Hacker Marketing, you had Trust Me, I'm Lying, which, you know, had varied reactions in the market. Mm-hmm. So how has your thinking changed on book marketing? And also, how has the industry changed?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Trust Me, I'm Lying is now, we're coming out with the 5th anniversary edition next week or a week after. And it's been interesting for me to redo my first book, you know, and to remember that I thought it had to come out so quickly at the time. Like I thought if I didn't get it out, it wasn't going to sell. And now I wish I'd taken a little bit more time on it. So that goes to our previous conversation. But I think what I've learned is that if a book doesn't make noise, it's very hard for it to get an audience. Mm-hmm. So it's okay to be controversial. It's okay to piss a few people off. If your book doesn't stand out, it almost makes it irrelevant how good it is, right? So think about it. If you wrote a masterpiece, but nobody knows that it exists, how is it really a masterpiece and will it be seen as one? And so I think marketing is essential on books. I think my sort of rule of thumb is like, you should stick with the marketing on a book for as long as you put into writing it, right? So if you took a year to write it, your marketing campaign should be about a year. Mm-hmm. But I think what often happens, and maybe you and I as marketers sort of understand this a little bit better, is that someone will spend 2 years on a book and then 2 weeks marketing it and then go, people didn't like it, I'm going to start the next one, right? And so they tell themselves they're being prolific, but really they're afraid to really put their work out there and get behind it. And I think that's a mistake.
Mm. Well, you know, looking at your marketing, you know, I share a lot of your articles.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, well, they're very good. And this is the point. You actually write incredibly long, content-rich articles, whereas you're kind of known before with the sort of Trust Me, I'm Lying was the more stunt-based sort of things. So has that been a big shift for you in terms of moving into content marketing on personal branding around that deeper content?
No, not really. I think it depends on the project, right? So Trust Me, I'm Lying is a controversial book, so I wanted controversial marketing. You know, The Obstacle Is the Way is a sober sort of book about philosophy. It would be weird to be too flashy about that, right? Or Perennial Seller is a book about, you know, timeless work that sells itself. It would be weird if I was buying billboards in Times Square to advertise for it, right? So I think the marketing has to match the work. And if it doesn't, that's a problem in either direction, right? So I do think getting attention is particularly important when you're launching your career as well. You know, one of the benefits of having a platform or building up a fan base is not that you need to do less marketing, but that your marketing shifts from speaking to the entire world to speaking to your kind of tribe of people. Mm-hmm. And so that's definitely a change that I've tried to make.
But have you found yourself, because you're writing for some sort of bigger publications as well now. Is that a deliberate targeting for your marketing, for you and the company and your books?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always trying. I tend to find that the best advertisement for your writing is more writing, right? So I'm trying to write things that deliver value to people. And I am trying to think of different audiences, right? So if I'm going to write a piece about how a book gets made, that's going to be, you know, probably for aspiring writers. If I'm writing a piece about, you know, how an issue is sort of dissecting an issue in the media, that's going to be for people who are interested in that. If I'm writing a book about an article about self-improvement, that's going to be somewhat of an advertisement for my philosophy and my self-improvement book. So it is about thinking about who each piece is for. But I think trying to have a diverse number of subjects that you cover is very important, right? Like if I was only writing about writing and book marketing, that tribe gets very small very quickly. Mm. I want to have a big tent with lots of different tribes in it.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I've been refocusing on content marketing, but a lot of people think that it's done, that social media or video or, you know, other things have taken over. Do you think there's still a place for, well, obviously you do, for the long form content marketing, but if someone is launching a nonfiction book now, you know, should they be going back to the sort of SEO fundamentals of long form?
Well, I don't know about SEO, but I mean, I think it's interesting. It's like, you wrote a book, right? So you want people to read it. You could be amazing at video, but there's going to be a huge percentage of people who are watching those videos who only watch videos and don't read books. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, if you create articles, by definition, the people who read them are people who read, right? So I tend to see people invest in these various platforms and not stopping to ask, am I really building a relationship with an audience around my writing, which is the thing that I do? So I think certainly there are opportunities out there for other different types of marketing, and I think you should take advantage of them. But, you know, the idea that because Facebook rolled out video, that the main form of human communication for thousands of years is suddenly going to become irrelevant is just preposterous to me.
Yeah. And I guess it's also personal preference, because you do put out, I mean, have you calculated, do you have more words out in articles than you do in books? Because your posts are massive.
I would imagine. Yeah, I would imagine at this point, I probably do. And look, here's the thing that I always tell authors. It's like, okay, you just wrote a 60,000 word nonfiction book. That is many, many articles that you can break up. Like, you can reuse that same content. You know, you could take 2,000 words from the book, edit that down to 1,500 words, then add 500 new words in terms of better transitions and an intro and a conclusion. And all of a sudden, you have an amazing 2,000 word article that, frankly, is going to stand out against other articles better because you put sort of book level effort into it, whereas everyone else is writing these crappy listicles. So I think really putting in that work is important. And yeah, I see them as both advertisements for my books and sort of ways to continue to explore the ideas that are in my books.
Yeah, and I agree with you on that. I see the problem with content marketing is people are taking blog posts and turning them into books instead of the other way around. So what are your thoughts on that, the blog to book approach?
Well, I think if you are blogging and building an audience and then you're creating higher quality versions of some of those same ideas into a book, I think that makes sense. I think the problem is people have very low standards for what they write online. You know, it's like, oh, this is, you know, they basically write in sort of, I've worked on a number of projects with some internet marketers, and they're really effective copywriters, and they don't understand that there's an enormous difference between the quality of prose in copywriting and what there is in a book, right? Copywriting is, keep reading, and eventually I'll tell you why you're reading this. You know what I mean? Or eventually I'll sell you something in exchange for reading. And a book has to deliver the value itself, right? Like copywriting, I tend to find there's no there, right? Because that's the whole point. You're trying to get me to keep scrolling until I get to a box, and then I click okay and give you my credit card. Well, with a book, you've already given me your credit card in a sense, right? And so every page has to deliver a return on that investment. And so I tend to find, people are going about it the wrong way. I think you want to write in a in a more secluded setting with a longer term view in mind. And then you want to adapt that writing for the more fluid, you know, sort of environment of the internet. And rather than trying to write ephemeral stuff for the internet and try to make it last in a book.
Absolutely. And it was interesting. I do quite a lot of futurist stuff on my show. And, you know, I love the idea of the Bowie bonds and buying into an artist's future. And we're seeing a lot of the kind of ICOs, the coin offerings that people are doing, the economy, the blockchain economy for independent artists. So, you know, given that we're looking at perennial selling and where artists are going, what do you think, where do you think the world is going for artists in the next sort of 10 years?
Well, there's an interesting site that just launched called Royalty Exchange that lets you bid on the rights to royalties from songwriters and artists and now writers. So I think it is interesting. We're starting to see, like, I think people have forgotten that when you do this right, you know, if you create a book that, like, What to Expect When You're Expecting, that would have been an incredible asset to have acquired in the early 80s, right? Like, that's a book that just spins off royalties. It doesn't have a lot of marketing. It's almost all profit. And so intellectual property is incredibly valuable. If you could, like, think about a world where Shakespeare retained the copyrights to his works, right? Over the last 500 years, he would have accumulated billions of dollars if you think about all the things that have been based on those plays. And so I am hopeful that this sort of perennial content, that there will be more innovations in how writers are able to monetize their work. I think obviously self-publishing is a viable medium now and allows sort of mid-list authors and successful authors to monetize their work. I've also seen with mine, it's even though I traditionally publish and I make royalties from them, my books do well, I'm able to monetize my work because I have that direct relationship with my audience. So we've created posters that are based on my books and coins and different products that I can sell directly to those readers. And since I'm not trying to sell them through a store, the margins are pretty good. I know who my targeted customer is. It creates a universe around the product. So I think anyone who builds a platform where they have direct access to their fans is going to be sort of well suited for whatever the future of media happens to be.
Fantastic. And writing is definitely not going away. So
no, I mean, look, people thought that television was going to destroy radio. And radio is still around. You know, people thought that the internet was going to destroy newspapers, and, you know, the New York Times is having one of its best years ever. So we tend to think that new technology eliminates old forms, but in fact they continue to soldier on. And the longer that a form has been around, the longer it is likely to continue to stay is what the research tends to show.
Absolutely. Okay. So where can people find you and your book online?
Yeah. So ryanholiday.net. I'm at Ryan Holiday on pretty much every platform. And then Perennial Seller should be everywhere books are sold. I think you have the British edition, right?
Oh, yes. Does yours not look like this?
No. Is that the paperback or the hardcover?
It's the paperback.
Okay, yeah. So in the UK, it's a paperback, and in the US, it's a hardcover. But yeah, it's everywhere.
That's interesting you say that, because I was actually going to ask you, why isn't it a hardback? So that's because of the UK.
Yeah, and they did sort of a fancy version of the paperback, but I have a great UK publisher, and they know the market really well, and so they were like, "Here's what we think," and I said, "Awesome, let's do it," and it's done really well. I think it's in its second or third printing already.
Yeah, I've seen it in loads of bookshops, but I'm going to buy an American one because the books that I actually think I want to keep as perennial books on my shelf, like I am starting to buy hardbacks. So it's interesting how that's happening now.
Yeah, well, it's like we thought ebooks were going to replace hardcover books, but print books are having an amazing run the last couple of years because people are discovering books on The Daily Stoic, which is one of my books, is the deal on BookBub today, and so we're selling a ton of digital books. But I would imagine in 6 months we'll see a corresponding spike in print sales because people will have really liked it and go, "Oh, I want to have a copy to keep."
Yeah, and in audio as well. The benefits of nonfiction. Anyway, thanks Definitely. So much for your time,
Thank you
Ryan.
So much.
That was great.
All right. Awesome. Thank you.
So I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Ryan Holiday today. I certainly want to build a body of work for the long term and be a perennial seller. So I hope it sparks some interesting thoughts for you too. Next week, I'll be talking to A.K. Benedict, a friend of mine and a British supernatural crime writer, about writing audio dramas and also writing The Darkness coming up for Halloween. And Alexandra, A.K., has done Doctor Who and Torchwood, which is pretty cool. Cool if you like that type of thing like I do. And she also comes from music and performs and reads her work and is an introvert. So I ask her about tips for performing and energy management as an introvert performer. And I reveal some of my own insecurities around reading and she gives some great tips. I'll also be recording the introduction from Oregon. So look forward to that. So happy writing week and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.